Harry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 278th episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 277 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. And once again, under the radio show tab. In addition to my previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join us every week at this time, and the next week my guest will be Brooklyn poet Jim Hart, who called into the show last week with a wonderful poem, and I said I have to bring him back. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 22nd year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on 6th in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So June's meeting will be this Wednesday, June 19th, at 10 a.m. Coffee time on 6 and in the Red Mill section of Mahopac. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30 p.m., and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak, New York, at 6 p.m., so at the next meeting on June 26th. The open mic at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in the Philipsey Manor train station in Sleepy Hollow is this Friday coming, June 21st, at 7 p.m. The following week, on Saturday, June 19th, I'll be reading my poetry as one of the many poets at the Poets, Writers, and Storytellers stage at the 2019 Norwalk Arts Festival. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Now to this week's show, as mentioned, the 278th in the series. Tonight, I'm joined by Margot Tefsadeva, writer, poet, editor, publisher, and founder of the wonderful, the aforementioned Hudson Valley Writers Center. The listeners wishing to join Margot and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Margot. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, would you start us off with a poem and tell us a little about where it comes from?
Great. I'm going to read first a poem from my collection, Crack Piano, my second full-length collection, which was recently published by Cavan Carey Press. And I wanted to mention that this poem is titled The Lunatic Ball. And as I just wanted people to know that as part of a humanistic movement in the treatment of mental patients in the latter half of the 19th century, superintendents at insane asylums frequently helped balls considered therapeutic for their patients, and spectators were sometimes invited. The Lunatic Ball, After Dance in a Madhouse, a painting by George Bellows, 1882 to 1925. Furious dancing gives way to screams. Five men stare ghoulish at the wall. This is the Lunatic Ball. The best student Yale had ever seen. 3 months after graduation, typhoid, brain swelled inside his skull. They dosed out calomel. Five ghosts appeared in a mercury dream, headaches unbearable. This is a lunatic ball. Married 1 year, baby the next, his wife filed for release. The medical textbooks he gleaned, futile, endless stall. A woman names her baby doll Christ, lurches, leans, a building in an earthquake, then she crawls. This is the lunatic ball. One man plays a flute, calls himself Faunus. Another uses an invisible latrine. Attendants haul out a wild man in a straitjacket on a wooden beam. A woman growls like a bear. This is the lunatic ball. Behind the glass wall, well-dressed spectators, riveted, sit amused. Looking at them, looking, the patients know they are through. Spectacled men sport great coats and laced up women make jokes in the shimmering hall.
Wow, that's powerful, and obviously it relates to a time where we did not understand mental illness, and we thought if we just put these people away, did they get better, or they wouldn't? It's sad. Where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I went to grade school in a school called Lotz Beach School, which was located, in Cincinnati.
You come from the famous family line. Would you tell us something about it?
Well, I'm a member of the Taft family, and actually what inspired this book was that I was doing research for a book on William Howard Taft on the 1905 U.S. diplomatic mission to Asia, and I ended up reading a lot of the William Howard Taft papers, which I had not known about, and they contained a lot of family letters. And through those letters, I found out about my great-grandfather, Peter Rawson Taft, who this poem is about. He was institutionalized in the Cincinnati Hospital for the Insane, and because of the scourge of the hospitalization, he became a disappeared person in my family. So during my childhood, the only statement that I ever heard about him that was that my mother said, while William Howard Taft was a president, Peter was the first American to get a divorce. And that wasn't true. I mean, he did end up getting a divorce, but he certainly wasn't the first American. But that was the only thing I ever heard about him. But then reading these letters, I found out he had graduated from Yale as valedictorian of his class. And he was actually the best student Yale ever had at that time because everyone took the classics, and it was in the paper. They had a numerical score. So he obviously was a good student. And then he contracted typhoid 3 months after he graduated, almost died, never fully recovered, and suffered from terrible headaches for the rest of his life. And it's unclear whether the problems emanated from the ingestion of calomel, which was a mercury compound that was given in large doses to patients, or from brain swelling from lack of antibiotics or some other cause. But in any case, I was able to read all of these letters that he wrote, and I actually found all these amazing information about his life. And I think that it's interesting that because he was a disappeared person in our family, it really had a subliminal, perceptible, and continuing disruptive effect. And that's sort of what this book is about, both about him and about a lot of the sort of effects of that on our family.
So I know something about your family, obviously Robert and Charles, but I never really understood how Charles, who had been, I believe, governor of Ohio, how there's a school named after him in Connecticut. Did he later move to Connecticut?
Oh, no, that was a different brother. A different brother started the Taft School. Horace Taft started the Taft School. That was Alfonso Taft had two wives. His first wife died of consumption, and that was my great-grandmother, and she had two sons. And then the second wife had four children, surviving children, and Horace was one of those children who started the Taft School. But Charles Taft was one of the children from Alfonso's first marriage.
Oh, okay.
But then there was another Charles Taft, so it's really confusing. So there was another Charles Taft who was a famous Taft in Cincinnati who was in a later generation who started a political party and was much more liberal than most Tafts and did a lot of good work in Cincinnati.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
What
your earliest aspirations were, to what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Oh, that's a good question. My earliest aspirations. Actually, I do remember that I think I wanted to be a novelist when I was young. And I was also interested in plays. But I remember that I used to write stories. My father would get his secretary to type them up for me when I was really young. But, you know, I was always interested in writing, but I actually never thought of myself as a poet until I went to college and I had the incredible experience of taking a workshop at MIT from Denise Levertov, and I submitted some of my work, which I didn't even necessarily think was poetry, but she really helped me learn about poetry.
Were you an early reader?
Excuse me?
Were you an early reader? Did you read when you were very young?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember when I began to read, but I certainly read a lot and was very interested in reading. I was very obsessed with horses as a young girl and read a lot about horses, but I read a lot of other things too.
It's an interesting question. You said you didn't think of yourself as a poet. The woman that was on the show last week said that she and she's been writing some wonderful stuff, and she said that she never thought of herself as a writer, but she's been writing about an American pilot who gave his life to save a British city by crash landing and getting killed, and
wow.
She said she told her son, who's an actor and a writer. She said, well, I'm not a writer. He said, if you're not a writer, then stop writing. So she said, well, I don't want to do that. So he said, then you're a writer.
Right, exactly.
How about
a good answer.
The high school years? Did you write for a school paper or a literary journal?
Yeah, actually, we didn't have a literary journal at our high school, but I was co-editor of the school newspaper, and I think I was vice president of the school, and I don't know, I did student council as well, but yeah, I was interested in writing.
And what happened after high school?
Well, then I went to college, and it was during the 60s. I was admitted to Radcliffe, and it was a very tumultuous time, 68 to 72, and I was very much involved in the anti-war movement and did a lot of demonstrations. I was arrested during the Harvard strike, and let's see, I was involved in writing and doing a lot of photography. I took a lot of pictures that were published in a lot of journals, and very interested in poetry as well.
What was your field of study at Radcliffe?
Visual and environmental studies, which was kind of photography related mostly, and visual studies, you know, like art and photography.
A good friend of mine, well, the wife of my oldest friend was at Radcliffe at that time, Gail Domet Buckley.
Uh-huh.
She's Lena Horne's daughter, so I guess she was whatever Lena's married name was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you ever came across her.
I don't remember.
What happened after college?
Well, let's see. Then I'm trying to remember everything that happened. I mean, so many things, obviously. But let's see. Well, one thing that was interesting was that I worked for Senator Ted Stevens as staff assistant in Washington, and then moved back later when I was married with my husband a number of years later. When I first lived there, it seemed like almost nothing was going on in the area of poetry. Of course, I'm sure I was unaware of a lot of things and didn't have time to find out everything, but then when I moved back, it just seemed like there was a renaissance in the poetry world, and there were so many people writing, and people were interested in what other people were writing. It was just such an exciting environment to be living there during. And I think the Writers' Center in Bethesda had something to do with it. And there were also a lot of other organizations and presses that had started that were contributing to this feeling, this sort of feeling of a poetic renaissance in the city. And that, I think, inspired me to want to start the Hudson Valley Writers Center when I moved here. And that was just one thing that happened during my early life, because when I moved here, once again, it felt like living in the suburbs. There didn't seem to be that much going on. Of course, I'm sure that I wasn't aware of a lot of things that were happening, but it just felt very stultified in where I was living. I just was very sort of worried about what was happening. So I started, first of all, the Sleepy Hollow Poetry Series, which then slowly evolved into the Hudson Valley Writers Center over a long process.
You're way ahead of me. I know that you have a master's from Harvard in education.
Oh, I forgot about that, yes. I did.
Did you plan to teach then, or?
Well, I did teach. I actually got a master's, an EDM in reading and human development, and I taught at a school for children with learning disabilities in Lexington, Massachusetts, called the Krebs School. And then, after working there for a year, I ended up moving to New Hampshire and worked for the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. And then I also got married, and so then we moved to Dartmouth because my husband got a job at Dartmouth teaching environmental law. He's an environmental lawyer. And after that, I moved to Washington and had various jobs and a family, and then moved. Anyway, I did a lot of moving around.
Now, with your you're anti-war protesting, and you're working for the liberal group, it doesn't sound like you'd be a great fit for the conservative Republican like Ted Stevens. Was there any problem there?
Well, I didn't work for, let's see, when I worked for Ted Stevens, he was a Republican, but I mean, I wasn't working. I don't know what you mean by that, because
in other words, his politics didn't seem.
Oh, in other words, well, you know, I didn't have a very high level position, so I was just basically answering, you know, letters from constituents, which were, I don't know, it wasn't like I was running around talking at a high level with people about my personal views on politics, so it wasn't a problem.
And then what brought you to Midwestchester?
Well, then my husband got a job after he worked at the U.S. Department of Justice. He was the section chief of pollution control and environmental defense at the Justice Department. He got a job teaching at Pace Law School. They actually were voted as the best, having the best environmental law program in the country this year. But anyway, he was one of the people who worked there in the beginning of that, of the Pace Environmental Law Program, the Pace University Environmental Law Program. And that's why we moved here. And
when did you get the MFA in poetry from Sarah Lawrence?
1988.
And you mentioned that you became extremely active in the area, founding the poetry series in Sleepy Hollow, then founding the Hudson Valley Writers Center, and then founding Slapring Hollow Press. Could you tell us about each of these?
Sure. Well, I mentioned the sort of foundation of the Writers Center and some of my motivation for being interested in starting the Writers Center. Actually, I was first interested in starting a press, but it just seemed as if we didn't have the financial capability to do that. And we ended up getting a $3,000 decentralization grant from the Westchester Arts Council, which is now called Arts Westchester. And that enabled us to start a reading series at the Warner Library. That was the beginning of the Writers' Center. Pat Farewell, who is a poet, who actually recently moved back to this area, was one of the founding board members and also helped at the beginning of the Writers' Center. And a number of other people, Nick Robinson, my husband Don Stever, who's been without Don's help with and Nick's help with legal work, we never would have been able to start the Writers' Center. They just really did. And Don has continued to work. He's still doing amazing work for the Writers' Center. But anyway, let's see. We just worked we had to do a lot of fundraising to restore the building. That was a huge project that went on for at least 10 years and took a huge amount of work, because I mean, none of us were professional fundraisers, and we had to figure it out and submit grants.
Audience, it is headquartered in a terrific X station from MTA in the Philipsy Manor section of Sleepy Hollow, and
yes.
There is a continuing events on and on and on. There's the open mic that I mentioned earlier. There are classes. There are workshops.
There's actually a reading on Wednesday if people are interested. There's a memoir reading by two memoir writers, Kelsey Miller and Sarah Bracy White. And you mentioned Sarah earlier, but they're both reading at the Hudson Valley Writers Center on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday at 7:00. So if you go to www.writerscenter.org, you can see the full schedule, but there are readings by poets, fiction writers, memoirists, and creative nonfiction.
Yeah, it's a tremendous place. And then tell us about both the press, and where did that name come from? It's a very odd name to me.
Slapring Hall, Slapringhol is one of the iterations of Sleepy Hollow. We had initially thought of calling it Sleepy Hollow Press, but that name was already taken. So I was reading a history book, and that was one iteration of the way the Old Dutch wrote Sleepy Hollow. So that was the reason for that name.
Now, how often do you publish?
We publish probably on average about two chapbooks. We're a chapbook press. We're probably We're definitely one of the oldest chapbook presses in the United States, and certainly the oldest chapbook press around here. But anyway, we publish a couple of chapbooks. We have an ongoing series for poets who have not published books or chapbooks, and the due date for that chapbook contest is June 15th. And let's see, we also have another series in which a well-known woman poet chooses an emerging poet to appear in the same issue. And we started with Elizabeth Alexander and chose her actually before Barack Obama did. So, and she chose this amazing poet. So the idea is this master woman poet would choose an emerging woman poet to appear in the same issue. And she chose a poet named Lyra Van Cleef Stefanon, who is quite an amazing poet. And anyway, we've done about six of those chapbooks. And every once in a while, we do a special collection like Helen Barolini's Hudson River Haiku, which is probably our best-selling chapbook, which is a collection of haiku about the Hudson River with beautiful paintings by her son-in-law, who's a painter from Italy. But anyway, they're the Hudson River, and they're very beautiful.
Since we've gotten back into poetry, how about reading another poem?
Sure. let's see. I'm trying to see what I should read. I guess I'll read another poem. See, I've had two collections published in April, so, and it certainly never happened before and will never happen again that I have two poetry collections in the same month, but one is a chapbook that Cattywampus Press published. But I'm reading another poem from Crack Piano titled Idiot's Guide to Counting. How do you become one with the horse? Riding and becoming the act of riding, and the horse becoming the self and the other at exactly the same second, counting strides, counting muscle movement, counting fences, hurtling over them with the horse, counting the everything of one. How do you count? How do you pull a muscle turning over in bed at night? Measurements that change everything, counting back to everything, the everything of one, the pulled muscles of the back of one, the entanglement of one, the waves of particles counting back, the quantum. How to become one with the branches of a tree, a grandfather tree in an apple orchard that no longer exists. Separate one from tree, horse, counting numbers, counting the grandfather tree to find the solution of one.
I like it, too.
Thanks.
Before we get into more of your poetry, would you tell us about your book about William Howard Taft's 1905 mission to China and the photographs related to the trip?
Sure. Well, we had these photo albums in the Adirondacks at this camp that's owned by my extended family, and we had been looking at them. My son was a history student at Hampshire, and I hadn't really paid that much attention to him, to these photographs during my life, but he was a history student, so he was very interested in them and thought they were really worth studying, and it turns out that my great-grandfather went on this trip with William Howard Taft, along with a lot of other congressmen and businessmen. He was a businessman. I mean, this is a great-grandfather on my mother's side of my family. And he had one of they had just developed portable cameras at that time in 1905, and all these people on this trip had portable cameras. Alice Roosevelt was on the trip. Nicholas Longworth, who's also a relative of mine, was on the trip. And there were all these amazing stories and incidences, and there were articles every day. It was really – Alice ended up being the first celebrity of our country, really, because it didn't – with the new cameras, there were so many people with cameras that they were just constantly taking pictures. But not that many are left, I guess. And we just had this amazing opportunity to restore these photographs because they were already becoming silverized, and they would really eventually just turn into to sort of nothing, because that's what happens if you don't restore photographs. The image disappears. So we did a restoration project and studied the photographs. We interviewed historians. We also found a friend of Harry Fowler Woods who traveled with him, who had kept a diary. Harry Fowler Woods kept a diary, but we couldn't find it. Someone sent us these amazing letters that accompanied their, because they also went to Burma, India, Egypt, and Greece, not just to the countries that were part of this tour that William Howard Taft took, which included the Philippines and China and Japan. So anyway, it's just a very exciting trip with all, things going on in each country, and that's what the book is about.
And you also, I read in your biography, have the paintings in the Beinecke Library at Yale, and coincidentally, Bill Beinecke, who was one of the groups that got out of Yale, they call it the Miracle Class of 1936. He was a consulting client of mine and a terrific man, just a very nice person. And one of the things that he was the happiest about was that all of his children were Yale graduates. So Yale was very important to them.
Yeah. So that those albums are at we donated the original albums to the Beinecke Rare Book Library. Yes, and so they will be kept in the best kind of conditions that photographs can be kept in.
That's great. Talk about another poem before we get in to talking about your poetry.
Well, maybe what I'll do, I guess I'll read one more from Cracked Piano, and then I'll read a poem or two from my other collection, if that's okay.
So why don't you explain Cracked Piano to us, too, because that's an interesting story.
The Cracked Piano, the title, what the title comes from? Do you mean?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah, well, several of the poems in the collection are letters that I made into found poems, letters written by my great-grandfather. And in one of the letters, he talks about someone who is playing at the hospital on a cracked piano. And so, you know, just the letter is really a beautiful letter. I mean, I could read it to you if you want. It wasn't one of the poems I was going to read, but it's actually a pretty long poem, so I don't know.
Give us the one we're going to read, then.
Well, I think I might read another poem, which is a poem that is an elegy, actually, for my mother and also for nature, which is kind of gets into the next collection that I wrote about, which is about more about nature. My mother is dying. In the place where she belongs, suffering erases itself. Doves bring her seeds. Horses sleep next to her in the straw. Where she belongs, a welcoming place holds her, keeps her from running away. The greenness of the hay turning to gold. Already the rain's restless trajectory, my mother is busy dying. She no longer knows my name. This is the wind of Eden, the wand of change, the last slave of silence, the knave of rain. So quiet the roving of each vacant quest. Let her be buried in the sea by the seaberry, the briar rock, the fossil chamber. Alone, blown, roadside stray, the flown, restless, wayward ringing. Bells clang, ocean downcast rolls. Wandering once again, now I return to the center, searching the level earth, calling her name, remembering that I am lost. The path unfurls before my dog and me, walking to the rocks, the ocean on one side, the bay on the other, eiders blessing the waves. The seagull's spontaneous burst. How it hurts with the radio blaring. My mother is dying, gone from a body that has abandoned her. Cry because everything goes haywire, because this is Apollo's siren lyre, the field-worn answer, the childless response, children waiting for some god to bring them home.
Was it Alzheimer's?
She had COPD, actually. She died of that.
Yeah, my brother, who was a college professor for 40 years and always had a book with him. He had four masters, and he always had some book either relating to his to his field or to baseball. He was a nut Red Sox fan. For the last 10 years of his life, he had Alzheimer's and reached the point
wow.
he didn't know who I was or who my wife was or anything like that. It was terribly debilitating. It was very
yeah.
difficult to
yeah.
illness. You know, it's difficult. COPD,
it's such a
as you probably know,
illness. Yeah.
It's an umbrella that goes all the way from bronchitis to what do you call it? I'm going, it's
like
going right out of my emphysema.
Yeah.
And
like
I have not had a cigarette for 39 years, and I was diagnosed last year as just having emphysema, as was my wife. And I don't have it in an extreme case, and she doesn't have it even to the extent that I do, but it's just the idea of it. And I get so angry at the ads that we used to see on television of the people who were dressed in the white gown, like doctors who were telling us that Camel was good for my T-zone, when many of the companies knew that they were killing us, you know. And it's very difficult. Was your mother a smoker?
Yeah, she was. Yeah, she was a manic depressive alcoholic too. So she had a lot of problems, but yep.
Well, now from that to we'll go right into your poetry. I mentioned earlier that I'm reading in Connecticut in a few weeks. You, on the other hand, have read in London, Shanghai, and all three United States. And your first chapbook was published only in 1996, and your first complete book of poetry in 2002. Would you take us at your own pace through your writing history right up until your most current book?
Well, do you mean just talking about the books that I've published, or do you want me to talk about process, or what would you...
Yeah, talk about your writing career, because you publish in journals all over the place. And, I mean, you read all over the place. And, of course, the process that you write with, you mentioned that you didn't consider yourself a poet and said you had this course at MIT. When did you get very heavily into writing and start submitting and...
Well, I think that really I started in my first year of college when I took the workshop with Denise Levertov, and at that point I kind of committed myself to the world of poetry. So I dedicated myself in one way or another to that world, whether I was reading or writing or working on the Writers' Center or working on Slapping Hall Press. You know, different aspects of writing, but I've always, since then, devoted myself to that, even if I had other jobs.
Well, with everything that you're doing, the writing, the related travel and reading, the editing, any writer-centered activities, how do you keep it all going, and how do you allocate your time? Where do you write, and what tick something off for you to write about?
Well, I think that at different times in my life I've had different methodologies for working, and the best method that I think is to keep a journal and to write in a journal every day whatever it is that is really on your mind. And certainly these days there's so much that could be on everyone's mind, but So that would be the main thing. And then making poems from those journals cannot be like composing music, really, because you can put things together. So I rarely sit down and write a poem all in one sitting, but, you know, it's happened rarely.
And when did you begin to actively submit the work you first published, and then take us from there through your publishing history and everything?
Well, Denise Levertov actually helped our class by submitting several of our poems to Hanging Loose, which was then, well, is still a literary magazine. Actually, that a friend of mine who took the workshop with Denise Levertov is now an editor of, but in those days, she submitted our poems to Hanging Loose, and she also submitted a poem for me to an anthology that Doubleday published, which is titled No More Masks, which was poems by women, and then they did another issue of No More Masks, another anthology later, but I was in the first one. Well, anyway, just after that, I just have submitted poems. I mean, I'm not someone who just runs around constantly submitting poems, and nor do I consider myself tremendously prolific, but I do, from in time to time, submit poems. And
when you have the various books, do you start off with the theme to begin with, or do you have the collection, the poems that all of a sudden you say, this really fits in this? Maybe if I added 2 or 3 or 10 other poems, it would be a book. What do you start off in the beginning? Say, I want to write a book about, to mention the crack piano, to women dying and people losing their mother and that type of thing.
Well, I mean, my first full-length collection, Frozen Spring, was, I mean, because, you know, because anyone writes on sort of a thematic basis, I would say, probably, you know, that the book was, a lot of it was about the death of my father, the death of my brother, you know, just kind of early childhood memories and realities, and also nature poems. But that's kind of what I wrote about in Frozen Spring. What, you know, what was really on my mind.
And one of the hardest things that new poets seem to have is when they're finally talked into submitting things. A is figuring out where to send things, because there are so many journals out there, and two, to dealing with rejection, because so many people, most people get rejected, and
yeah,
until become Billy Collins, and then they submit someplace else. There are some people who give up after very short. Do you advise people A, to where they might submit things, the way Amy Holman does as a business?
Well,
or do you?
I certainly could. I mean, I have given workshops and have talked on that subject, and I have certainly, because I've been doing this for so long, and I've been rejected a huge amount, you know, just constantly, and certainly know all about that. But also, I think that, in my view, the best thing is to find a writer who you really like and see where they're published and look at those journals, but also go to readings, you know, I think poetry is like any other world. If you have a connection, like if someone says, I know the editor of blah, blah, this press, and you should, you know, submit there, then that's a really good lead. And having some kind of personal knowledge does sometimes help. Like if you can say, you know, John, whoever he is, recommended that I submit poems to you, and I really enjoyed reading your journal, and I especially like these poems. I mean, say something about an issue of the journal in your letter. I mean, you know, there's just a whole, it's like any other field. There's a whole sort of methodology for trying to do things, and you have to sort of learn what it is if you're interested.
Dennis, beyond that, even to know who the editor is, I remember when I had Terry Hummer on the radio show, who's reading at Hudson Valley with the next week or two, I think.
At the Writers' Center.
He had been the editor of Review, and I mentioned to him that he was published often in the New Yorker. So he said, yes, there used to be an editor who really liked my stuff. Then they changed the editors, and the next guy didn't at all, so I never got to have anything published. Now
right.
I have a new editor,
right.
And I'm getting published again.
Well, that happens all the time. That's happened to me. I mean, it's really sad when you've been in the field this long. I mean, you have an editor who likes your work, and then they retire, or they move on to someplace else, and then they change the whole orientation of the magazine, and you know they're suddenly doing language poetry, and you don't fit in, and that happens all the time. So, but there are a lot of literary magazines, so you just have to find the ones that are publishing work that's like the work that you're writing.
Do you use Duotrope or the Poets and Writers or any of the databases that point you to places? Or
well, I look at Poets and Writers magazine, or I certainly have in the past. I don't use Duotrope, but I know other people who do. I mean, there's so many different things to look at. So many different things. Newpages.com?
Yes, that's another one.
That's one, and then
that's
there's
a good one.
What's the other one that has all those funny letters in it? They constantly send out calls for manuscripts from literary magazines. But
I like Trump very much because in addition to the database, there's a weekly newsletter of new markets. And if you think something's interesting, and if you go from them, they also have statistics.
Do
what the rejection is.
How much do they charge?
$50 a year.
$50 a year, that's all?
Yeah. How much they have, what's the rejection rate, and I find that to be a terrific service.
And I think.
So how about? Go ahead.
Well, it's sort of like applying to college. I mean, you have the places where you would really like to be published, places that might not be that hard to get into. You know what I mean? It just depends on what you want, but.
Sure. How about another poem?
Sure. I think that that my chapbook, Ghost Moose, is about the sixth extinction, which is something that I think is on a lot of the minds of us. And so I thought I'd read a few poems from that collection, if possible.
Okay, go.
The first poem I'll read is the title poem, Ghost Moose. Searching for moose, the children run down to the river, calling the already gone, the forgotten, for freedom of stench, the smell of skunk weeds. Moose calves become ghosts, rubbing fur, skin, scraping ticks off on tree bark. In mild winters, ticks multiply and multiply, occupy moose calves, killing them slowly. Their mothers witness starvation from blood loss. Moose calves resemble ghosts, tearing fur, skin. Calves waste away, wasted bodies frighten the forest floor. Foresters call April the month of death.
Okay. I wanted to do one more from there.
All right, I'll read another poem that's set in the future. End of Horses. I write to you from the end of the time zone. You must realize that nothing survived after the horses were slaughtered. We sleep below the hollow, burned-out stars. We look beyond dust bowls, searching for horses. When you walk in the country, you will be shocked to meet substantial masses on the road. We do not know whom to blame or where the horses were driven, who slaughtered them, or for what purpose. Had the horses slept under the linden trees, the generals and engineers pucker and snore on the veranda.
Do you have another one from the same collection that you'd like to read before? One.
From the chapbook?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. This is, I mean, a lot of, the number of the poems are, as I mentioned, about the sixth extinction. People are probably remember recently 1,001 dolphins washed up on the shores of France. So I'll read Ballad of the Dolphins. Ancient Greeks said they should be treated as humans. Their sailors would not kill dolphins. How I have thought of you, caught in the fishermen's nets. They would set them to trap you to catch the tuna that swam under your schools. How the fishermen hung you still alive upside down. Your cries brought others. Fishermen grabbed you by your tails, strung you, and turned you head down in water, tied you to lifting hooks, and dragged you to the docks. If any of you were still alive when they slung you on cement, they stabbed you. How the survivors churned the water red, leaping in panic, waiting to die. In a good catch, it took them 3 days to kill all of you. How the mothers whose calves were entangled could not lift them to the surface. They listened to their helpless underwater clicks and sighs. How often I have thought of the whale skippers who would radio the location of hundreds of you, allowing tuna fishermen to track down your entire pod. Think of their nets, deep, foaming, wide, so that hundreds could fit inside. How they used underwater sound to confuse and drive you down. How many of you drowned? Fishermen did not want to compete with you, but killing you was not enough. How they used the screams of several to slaughter more. How one of you hangs from the prow, still alive, calling, calling.
We were just down at the Jersey Shore, and there was not only were the dolphin watching cruises, but there were also them jumping up right out of the beach, and it was like a show. They're such beautiful and intelligent animals, and
they are, and
for them to go away would be awful.
Well, it's amazing that we treat these animals that are, I think, as intelligent, maybe more intelligent than humans, like pigs. The way we treat pigs is so horrific and ghoulish. That, you know, we treat factory farm animals in the most ghoulish way. And, I mean, people should think about what Gandhi said, that you can judge a society by the way they treat their animals.
I agree completely. What's next for Margot Stever?
Well, let's see. What's next for me is I'm doing a lot of babysitting for my 3-year-old granddaughter, which is really exciting. And I'm also working on another collection of poems and working on trying to help out with the Hudson Valley Writers Center in any way that I can, such as we have a benefit coming up to try to raise money. We're working on a capital campaign to try, you have to restore the building again, even though we restored it in 1996. We already have to restore it all over again and try to bring the energy systems up to the current standards, which they aren't at all. And so those are some projects that I'll be working on.
Does the new collection have the theme or a target date, or is it just something
Something that I'm just going to start working on. I mean, I think the theme will be nature and the sixth extinction, because I think that no one in this day and age should be doing anything except focusing on trying to keep us from this apocalyptic reality that we're approaching, and we have to try to fight against the end of the world. I have a grandchild, and I care about her future, so that's what I'll be writing about.
It's more than the environment. It's everything that, in my judgment anyhow, is being ruined under this current administration.
Well, I agree.
whether it's politics, whether it's the social network, whether it's a whole lot of stuff.
But I think it's true, absolutely. But and one of his main themes is that that our current president doesn't believe in global warming and climate change, which is something that I think that all of us have to band together to deal with now. It has been known since the 1980s. Scientists told people in government they knew it, but they did nothing in the 80s. Now we have a last chance to do something, and if we don't do it now, our children will suffer beyond anything, and our children's children, that we can possibly imagine.
And there are places that we depend on, like Manhattan Island and Miami Beach, that may just go away. You know.
Oh, well, Florida will be underwater. The butterflies will be dead. It's already probably dead. The monarch migration is destroyed. I mean, all these iconic species are going to be destroyed. Right in front of our eyes, it's happening right now. And what are we doing? We're electing idiots.
And the fact that they're going to allow hunting in Yosemite and in Yellowstone and things that they never did before, you know, all these things. You're absolutely right. I don't want to turn the show into a political diatribe, but that's
okay.
Real.
Yeah.
We've touched a lot the bases tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
Well, let's see. Well, I guess, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say exactly what else to talk about. I mean, I'm someone who really believes in the importance of mind and body and how, you know, it's very important to do, you know, to think about exercise. And I'm really involved in doing kind of exercise things, and I don't know, just what else would you like to know about me?
No, just what's on your mind that you want the audience to know about you, that's all.
I guess the main thing that's on my mind is right now is just thinking about my grandchild and wanting her to have a decent life and worrying about the future. I have a son who will not have children because he doesn't want to bring children into this world, which is sad to me. Why? I mean, it's just in our generation, in my own lifetime, that we now have to come to grips with what is happening in the world. I don't think any other generation has had this incredible necessity that is in front of us, and we need to realize that. That's the main thing that's on my mind right now.
Okay. Then would you take us off with another poem?
Okay, let's see. Maybe I'll read the last poem in Cracked Piano. Bottomland. Evening tidings, the preparations, each nestle, each cheep, like chicks calling, the winnowing anomy, all come to call too late, come to call for sleep. How a mother can change from angel to sour mud queen of all decay, by those who feel the sting, by those who cry out. Flail my heart upon the stone in the grove near the river bank, rushing water to the river break. Even the known becomes unknowable. Their small eyes look at me like chicks gathered against rain, staved. Thin rivulets of fear running away with itself, fear, fearful fear. No one can talk to you. No one can listen. No one can touch you. This is not stillness. This is not the keeper of the estuary of the deep. Don't forget me. Don't forget that hill the horses cantered you down to the bottom land. From this stone, ageless heart, remember your mother, a mother who loved her children.
I like that ending. To make it extremely personal for any of us, not just your children. Thank you, Margo. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I hope I hope everyone will come to the Hudson Valley Writers Center to some of the wonderful readings that we have there. Wonderful writers, including T.R. Hummer and many, many people coming up.
I agree completely. Send any comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com. And be sure to join us next week at the same time with poet Jim Hart. Go to my my website, www.johnmack13.com, for URLs of previous shows, schedules of upcoming shows, and a bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon. Now, in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. And until next time, I see the Sandy Old Neighborhood. See ya. And we'll go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Here's Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
Thank you very much, Margo. And good night, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I found out.